you have any reasonable amount of insertion loss of your transmission line. Because at 30 watts is bouncing back and forth with 100 watts, you are getting some extra loss of the line. Let me drop. Because the usual definition of insertion loss is how much the signal becomes weaker when the signal flows through the line once. But because you've got a bouncing system, because of standing wave ratio, now the signal is going through that line multiple times, experiencing the insertion loss multiple times. Therefore, the real insertion loss of the cable climbs to a higher number because of this one. You go to the right curve that's in the ARRL antenna book under the subject of standing wave ratio and transmission lines, they'll show you a curve where you enter the set of curves with what is the insertion loss of your cable when well matched, what is the VISWR of your antenna, and the graph will tell you what is the new insertion loss of your cable because the signal is bouncing back and forth. But an antenna tuner, properly designed and properly used, does not waste power. And that matching network that you put at this 32-foot-long, 80-meter dipole, that L network that you put there, if you've done it with the right kind of components, it wastes no power. The 0.4 dB is not power loss, it's not efficiency loss. It's a slightly fatter antenna pattern. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a couple of comments.
Quick statement. Would it be fair to assume, Dick, that once the tuner is tuned properly, it is now transparent, and if you took measurements in the cable going to the antenna, it would not see any effect of that tuner? Once it's tuned properly, it's totally transparent? Is that a fair assumption?
You've used a complicated set of words there, John. You got to be careful on this one. If you're now making measurements on the cable going to the antenna, and if the antenna has a 5-to-1 VISWR, and the cable has, let me pick a number, 0.5 dB of loss, in the shack you're going to measure an apparent 4-to-1 standing wave ratio. It gets a little bit lower because of insertion loss. Does the antenna tuner make the transmission line transparent? No. It forces the crazy impedance of your antenna, when reflected by way of a Smith chart, so to speak, through the number of wavelengths of your transmission line. If your transmission line was lossless, let's keep it simple, and if your antenna had a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio, no matter how long you make that lossless transmission line, you will always measure exactly a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio in the shack. You make the transmission line longer, shorter, 3 wavelengths, 3 1/3 wavelengths, and so on. You'll measure a 5-to-1 VISWR that sometimes is 5-to-1 wrong in resistance, or 5-to-1 wrong because of reactance, but it'll always be a 5-to-1. The antenna tuner will take that specific line length that you've settled on, with a particular dot on the Smith chart, which is the 5-to-1 circle, so to speak, and somewhere in that circle is your dot because of your length of transmission line, and your antenna tuner will take that particular dot, transpose it into 50 ohms resistive with no reactance on the transmitter end of the antenna tuner. It does that impedance match. Would you call that transparency? There's too many ways that can be misinterpreted.
But then the transparency would have to be what the transmitter would view.
Okay. You want the transmitter to see 50 ohms resistive because that's the way the manufacturer designed it. It gives you the rated amount of performance, power output, efficiency, and third order intermodulation distortion. Your transmitter will only meet all of its performance specs if it sees a 50 ohm resistor with no reactance. And a properly used wide enough range antenna tuner will always make the transmitter see 50 ohms. Now, I guess you can plug in the word transparency there if you want to. I'd rather use the word impedance match, conjugate impedance match. I'd rather use that set of words. I think it's a little bit closer to the truth. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, well, I was just thinking if the antenna and the cable were a perfect match, you don't need a tuner. So basically, when you put a tuner in with an imperfect match and it does the match, now it's transparent. That's just the way I was looking at it. And I know Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, the vocabulary of John Beck and the word transparency is a beautiful match in your mind, John. I have seen in my engineering world where the word transparency in that environment means something entirely different. I mean, I think that rose is red. You and I, you call it red, but your mind might see something a little bit different. Well, the word transparency has funny meanings, and I'd go a little slow on it. It can more easily be misused. I'd rather say impedance match. Conjugate impedance match gets rid of reflection, forces the transmitter to see nothing but a 50-ohm resistor, which is what it wants to see, and you call that transparency. I'm a little reluctant to use that set of words. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, this reminds me of an experiment I did about 3 years ago where I had a 20-meter antenna somewhat configured into an inverted V, and I was using 14-gauge wire on the end of it. And I had mounted a box that I had assembled from a company called Surplus Parts of Nebraska, and I was able to get some really super-duper parts from them, variable vacuum capacitors and huge inductors. And basically I made like a 5,000 kilowatt antenna tuner that could tune from like about 500 kilohertz to 30 meg, easy, without even, you could run a California kilowatt through this thing, and it was cold as a cucumber. There was virtually no losses at all in that, in this thing deck. Absolutely amazing thing. It weighed about 60 or 70 pounds when I was done, and I kind of had it mounted on a pipe off the side of the roof, and then ran the wires from my dipole inverting V from the side of the roof down, which was kind of interesting. Worked very, very well, but what I did find was that when I was going lower and lower in frequency, that the losses weren't in the cable, they weren't in the tuner, but what I started noticing was that the wire connections, especially at the side of the tuner, became very, very critical, because apparently I was starting to get some RAC and I2R losses on the bulkheading type of nuts and insulators that went into the tuner. So apparently the current flow was starting to get a little bit severe. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, an interesting experiment you did. Now, here I haven't done the mathematics on this one, so I'm going to make some jumps of assumptions. If my antenna had a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, and I've run antennas that high, I run antennas as high as 20-to-1 standing wave ratio and made some good QSOs with the right kind of an antenna tuner. So I've got a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio. I'm not sure if the numbers are exact, but let's assume that they are for a minute. Let's assume that antenna tuner, definitions of Q, is center frequency to just five different currents. Some now going to be a certain area of the snow chart. It would be nice to know the exact information to create a circle of that your impedance of your antenna into the good, if the antenna tuner manufacturer would give them that data. I'm really
you can get and tune on multiple
would be, yeah, 5 KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet, colored in, showing you which areas of the all possible impedances this antenna tuner will handle and give you a perfect 50 ohm. Have a couple of other circles in there. Go to the perimeter of the Smith chart, where the standing wave ratio is climbing to higher and higher numbers. You're in 500 watt rated, it's now only 100 watt, and you go even closer to the perimeter, it's now only a 50 watt antenna tuner. That would be very useful information.
From their maximum value. They weren't much higher than that. And the reason I was given from that by the manufacturers was that they didn't want to go much above a 3 dB variation in the peak value. It was because they said at one point you're going to have high current, another point you're going to have voltage breakdown and arcing across the capacitors. So they're like, when they do these designs, you have to watch the voltage arcing, and the other side you have to watch the current and the solder joints and that sort of thing. So there are kind of two end-of-the-box limitations that give you about a 3 dB swing, but not a heck of a lot more, Dick. K2RIW.
Within areas where it will match, and the extra set of circles that only take them and jump.
Yeah, great subject to talk about antenna tuners. It's a fascinating subject.
actually has happened to people. Are you taking that 100 ohm coax? It could be as low as 50 ohms if the antenna tuner would see 50 ohms. So the antenna tuner is going to see somewhere between 50 ohms and 200 ohms when it's resistive. And on other lengths of cable, it's going to see some amount of capacitive reductive reactance. It's always going to see a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on the 100 ohm cable. However, at certain lengths of that 100 ohm cable, the antenna tuner will see 50 ohms when it's exactly a multiple of a half wavelength of 100 ohm cable. Of course, this is a crazy system. The bottom line is the antenna tuner doesn't care what you put on the output. Let me drop. Your eye sees something that you think is going to be creating an explosion, so to speak. You're feeding the output of the antenna tuner into a 100 ohm cable, 25 ohm cable. You're feeding it into balanced 600 ohm transmission line. No matter what you put on the output end of an antenna tuner, it eventually boils down to a dot somewhere on that Smith chart of real impedance. When I say real, I mean a real resistive value and a real reactive value. There's going to be a dot somewhere on that Smith chart. And as long as that dot on the Smith chart, which is the real output impedance the antenna tuner is going to see on its output end going into your crazy transmission line system, as long as it's inside of the good area of the Smith chart where the antenna tuner is rated, it'll do the job. It'll convert that crazy impedance with this weird mixture of 600 ohm line going into a 50 ohm piece of coax, going into an antenna with a high visor. You know, you can make some very crazy systems. But ultimately, that boils down to a dot on the Smith chart, and the antenna tuner says that's either inside of my good range and I can match you, or it's not quite there and I can get you close. I can take your 10-to-1 visor and I can bring it down to a 2-to-1, so to speak. See, the antenna tuner is not a black and white where it absolutely does it or doesn't do it. If it runs out of range, it's making an improvement. It just can't bring you all the way, if you know what I mean. But if it's a good design, and as long as you're not really pushing it, I mean, your antenna tuner, maybe it's rated for 500 watts. Let me drop it. But it's rated for 500 watts as long as the antenna is less than a, as long as the impedance is less than the 3-to-1 visor, voltage standing wave ratio, SWR, standing wave ratio. If it's less than 3-to-1, it can take 500 watts. And if your particular combination happens to be a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, maybe it's only good for 80 watts, so to speak, as long as you're not exceeding that number. He's always going to make an improvement for you, and he's going to be doing it, if he's of good design, he's going to be doing it almost losslessly. I will admit, as the VizWar climbs higher and higher, and he's got to work harder and harder, he will create some more insertion loss, and it makes some sense, because if the antenna tuner is running at a 10-to-1 Q, a Q of 10, then somewhere in there the current is 10 times higher than normal, and somewhere in there the voltage is 10 times higher than normal. And by definition, all of your components, unless they're absolutely perfect, are going to have a little bit more insertion loss. So the insertion loss of the antenna tuner will climb slightly as you start asking it to work harder and harder. But still, in almost all circumstances, if it's a reasonably good design, 90% of that power is going to get to the feed line going to the antenna. W-E-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Okay, I'm not sure if you completely answer the question. I understand what you're saying with the antenna tuner matching the impedance from the input to output, but what happens in a case, like, just like you said, if you're running into, say, a 100-ohm transmission line, 100-ohm and length of 50 at a particular frequency, wouldn't you have a mismatch at the juncture between the 100-ohm cable and the 50-ohm cable? And does that cause additional reflections in your system? I mean, normally, I guess people wouldn't normally do that, but in a case like for this discussion, wouldn't that be also what's going on? And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, in the first example I gave, Joe, I had a 50-ohm perfect antenna and a 50-ohm perfect piece of coax traversing, let's say, 50 feet. But that didn't bring me all the way back to the shack. And now from that point to the shack, I put in a piece of 100-ohm coax. And now the 50-ohm coax to the antenna, it always has a 1-to-1 visor. It's happy. The 100-ohm coax wants to see a 100-ohm load, but it's looking into a 50-ohm load. by definition, the 100-ohm coax will be operating at a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio inside of that coax. The standing wave ratio occurred at the junction where the two pieces of cable, the 100-ohm and the 50-ohm cable, matched. That's where the VISWR occurred. The 100-ohm cable wants to see a 100-ohm load, and you put a 50-ohm load there. It could have been a 50-ohm resistor. It happened to be a 50-ohm piece of coax going into a 50-ohm antenna. Doesn't matter. Now, coming back to the shack end of that 100-ohm coax, depending on the length of the 100-ohm coax, the antenna tuner might see 50 ohms. It might see 200 ohms. Either case, that is a 2-to-1 VISWR for the 50-ohm coax. If you're smart enough to choose a 100-ohm coax to be an integral multiple of a half wavelength long, where it repeats the impedance from output end to input end, that's the magic of transmission line that is an exact multiple of a half wave. It repeats the impedance from input out, output end, no matter what the impedance of the line is. Ain't that crazy? It could be 200-ohm line, it could be 20-ohm line. If it's exactly a multiple of a half wavelength long, it will reflect the same input impedance and output impedance. It'll be the same number, even though the line itself is running at a high VISWR. So the antenna tuner, in the best case, might see 50 ohms when it's...
Repeater, timeout.
In the best case, if you're smart enough to set it up just right, the antenna tuner will see 50 ohms, and it doesn't have to have an antenna tuner at all if you're smart enough to choose the exact length of the 100-ohm cable. But be careful now, that's frequency sensitive. You go to a slightly higher or lower frequency or another band, and your transmission line is not a multiple of a half wavelength anymore. And now you're starting to walk around that Smith chart. So, your eye may see things that look like they're thoroughly incompatible. 100-ohm cable into a 50-ohm system looks like it's incompatible. Well, it can be very compatible if you're smart enough to choose the right length. For guys who want to save money, the 3/4-inch hard line and 7/8-inch hard line that's used for the cable TV company, which happens to be 70-ohm cable, if you had to buy cable of that insertion loss by way of Andrew Heliacs, you'd pay quite a few dollars per foot. You go to the stockyard where they use that stuff, where they bring the reel back, and there's only 200 feet left on the end of the reel, and it's a 5,000-foot reel in the beginning, and they don't want to throw it away, but they don't want to start another run down the block because they'd have to use a splice. So there's a whole bunch of reels in the stockyard with 7,500, 150 feet on it. You make a deal with a guy that 70-ohm cable, which is extremely low in loss, made for direct burial, really rugged stuff. A little bit difficult to put connectors on the end of it, but that's got very low loss compared to anything you're willing to buy under normal circumstances. So let me drop...
This is KG4 UFR.
UFR recognized. So now you're putting a 70-ohm cable into a 50-ohm system, and will that fly? You happen to be listening to my signal through a piece of 70-ohm cable right now. And how did I solve that problem? I put a piece of paper tape on the cable, 70-ohm cable. I put a piece of paper tape on it, and I wrote on that piece of tape 50 ohms. And I made sure that side of the cable is facing toward the transmitter and toward the antenna. And they never knew the difference. Turns out that a 70-ohm cable in a 50-ohm system is only a 1.4 standing wave ratio. Nothing bad happens. So it works like a charm. And if I was really an exacting guy, I could put an impedance matching device in there to match the 70 to 50. If I was a moon bouncer where I needed the last tenth of a dB of performance, I could make it perfect. But when it comes to inexpensive cable, it's very hard to beat the dollars per performance on that kind of stuff made for direct burial. KG4 UFR. Start up with your name, sir, and your question or comment. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Sorry, gentlemen, I didn't know it was the net. I'll let you guys get back to your conversation. I was just testing my radio here. Back to the net. Sorry about that. This is Kilo Golf 4, Uniform Foxtrot Romeo.
Yeah, Mr. UFR, you've got a nice clean signal, good audio. Nothing to complain about. Don't touch it. This is the technical net that runs on this repeater every Sunday night from 8 until midnight for the last 32 years. Ain't that crazy? So, as you can tell, the antenna tuners, boy, there's a lot of old wives' tale stories about how bad they are. A good percentage of the ham radio population thinks all the reflected energy back to an antenna tuner is simply absorbed and thrown away. Absolutely not. You don't lose any of it if it's of reasonably good design. People think that they're going to have a tremendous insertion loss of the antenna tuner. Not true. Loads and loads of guys are positive that the non-constant impedance inside of a UHF connector, you study a UHF connector, it's got about a 30 or 35 ohm impedance when it's mated. And so people think that because it's a 35 ohm connector in a 50 ohm system, they'd come up with a number, I don't know where the hell the number came from, of half a dB of loss for that connector. Let me drop. There's a whole bunch of guys out there that'll buy a Mirage amplifier, which has got a UHF connector on the input and a UHF connector on the output, and they go through the effort of converting those to type N connectors. They thought each UHF connector had half a dB of loss. They thought each type N connector has no loss. Therefore, they think the signal coming through that amplifier is now going to be a dB stronger because they've eliminated the loss of the connector. My goodness, that's a great sounding theory. Dead wrong. I, for one, have taken a UHF male, UHF female connector, took a 700-watt output parallel kilowatt strip line amplifier on 432 and ran a key down for 10 minutes, 700 watts through a pair of male and female UHF connectors. At the end of the 10 minutes, I went over there, turned the transmitter off, put my hand around that UHF connector, and it was mildly warm to the touch, which is probably 1 watt of loss. 1 watt of loss out of 700 watts is 0.001 dB. A 0.00006. It's less than 0.01 dB of loss. And people think it's got half a dB of loss on essentially all frequencies. Not on 432. The fact that it's 70 ohms, the fact that it's 35 ohms, doesn't matter. It's only an inch long. 432, the wavelength is 27 inches. So you put the wrong length of cable in there, and it's only a 27th of a wavelength long, and you study that on the Smith chart or Coke or by formulas or whatever. It's an extremely minor perturbation. It makes a 1.01 standing wave ratio, if you know what I mean. Something very low. Joe, I know you were asking questions on this. To B2RYY, T2RIW, and TechNet.
Well, I've heard something about the connectors before, but like you were saying with the operator, the antenna system, if you happen to say change frequencies, the antenna tuner is taking care of the line match at its output to the transmission line it sees. And if that impedance is different than like another section of the line you have in series with it, if you change operating frequencies moderately enough to get a 10% reflected power from the antenna, that's about a 2-to-1 visor, approximately something like that. So at that 50 ohm cable and 100 ohm cable junction, now you have a moderate mismatch. That's what I was talking about. What happens with that? The antenna tuner really can't handle that, can it? It handles it only from the point that you have a connector, but anything further than that, it causes additional mismatch in the system, causing other standing waves. You really can't deal with that, can it?
Hold on. You're saying you can't deal with it. Yes, it is doing an impedance match in the shack. It makes the transmitter see a 50 ohm resistor. That's the good news. Of all the power coming out of your transmitter, all of it goes up that line in the right direction with the best impedance match you can get. Yes, there is a mismatch with a 100 ohm cable mated with the 50 ohm cable 50 feet downrange in my example. And yes, there was a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio created at that point only in the 100 ohm cable. The 50 ohm cable has its load a 50 ohm antenna. It's matched. So there is a 2-to-1 visoir at that exact junction, because it's a 100 ohm cable mating with a 50 ohm cable. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, in the worst case, is half a dB of loss if you didn't correct it. Because of the way you're using the antenna tuner, if the 100 ohm cable was low enough in loss, you've got a 100% correction and there's no resultant loss. The only loss you get because of that 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is because the power in the 100 ohm cable is bouncing back and forth with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So the power is not going through the 100 ohm cable once, it's going through the cable multiple times because of the bounce. But in the worst case, a 2-to-1 Vizwar is only half a dB of loss. That doesn't knock you off the air. That's not a showstopper. A 2-to-1 Vizwar is a damn good match. Let me drop. Many of the broadband commercial antennas that you and I can buy, Joe, were commercial service, not high quality ham radio repeater service like a station master, but for commercial service, many of them are rated 2-to-1 standing wave ratio maximum somewhere in their frequency region. And if you're willing to pay some extra money, they'll give you the premium version of that antenna, which only exceeds 1.5, doesn't go above 1.5 standing wave ratio. 2-to-1 ratio, 2-to-1 Vizwar is not bad. We all lose sleep over that. And yes, our no-tune transmitters will go into the self-protect mode because the final stage of the transistor system can't tolerate a 2-to-1 unless you put some kind of a tuner there. In the old days, we had a Pi network. We just adjust the tuning and loading control, and the problem went away. So 2-to-1 Vizwar by itself is not bad. Half a dB of loss, worst case. Best case, nearly 0 dB of loss. It's only our no-tune transmitters that can't tolerate the 2-to-1 that's made us lose a lot of sleep over that one, Joe. For B2RYY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, very good. I have nothing more, no more questions on this particular subject. I'll be listening for a while. W2RYY.
Hey, John, we got very far left of field of a nice, innocent question on what is an isotropic antenna. However, I think it's educational. And you can go to the next one if you like. KC2WGB, K2RIW and TechNet.
Attention.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Now this one is gonna, he wants the long answer. He even wrote that in the email. But do the best you can. He's interested in doing experiments with ledger wire. And he wants to know, what is it? Does it have to be ledger wire? He wants to do the experiments using ledger wire and discovering the waves on the line. How would he set that up? What frequency would be best for the tests? And how does he get started? So maybe you can give him some tips. I'm sure he'll be back next week with further questions, but maybe you could get him going and he can start experimenting. Interesting question. He must be an antique. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Now, it's a very classic piece of history. Right now, you and I, John, are on the 2-meter band. Earlier today, you may have been on the 20-meter band. A week ago, you may have been on the 80-meter band. Why in the world do we call them 80 meters, 20 meters, 2 meters, instead of 3.5 megacycles, 7 megacycles, 14 megacycles, 146 megacycles? In the beginning, nobody had a frequency counter. Some number of years downrange, they came up with a tunable device called a frequency meter, which is a device that's got a great big dial on it. You turn the dial until you get a response on a meter, and then you read the dial and it says, yeah, you're on 14.15 megahertz. If the frequency meter, which was a simple resonator, had enough accuracy and enough range to it. So in the beginning, we couldn't measure frequency. Didn't have a counter, and it was even downrange before we had a frequency meter, a passive tuning device. However, with ledger wires, you could slide your neon bulb or incandescent bulb across your ledger wires and look for either a peak or a valley on one position on the ledger wire, slide it until you found another peak or another valley, and measure the distance between the two. And if the distance between the two was, let me pick a number now, 7 meters, and you knew that the ledger wire gave you alternate peaks or alternate valleys one half wavelength apart, you took the 7-meter number you just measured, and you doubled it, and you called it 14 meters, and you say, hey, I'm on the 14-meter band. I should have said that. 10 meters, 20 meters. You're on the 20-meter ham band. So you measured wavelength. That was the
repeater. Timeout.
In the early days when we stopped using spark transmitters and we really used crystal controlled or at least so-called coherent mode instead of incoherent mode. A spark transmitter is a very broadband device, and to try to put more than one guy in the band at once is very difficult. So when we went over to non-spark transmitters, particularly crystal controlled, in the case of the crystal, the crystal was bought for a particular frequency. Even before we used crystal controlled, we used a real tuned oscillator. And how did you find out what frequency you're on? With LetraWire. A LetraWire system is the open wire transmission line equivalent of a slotted line. In either case, whether it be LetraWires, which is a kind of open wire transmission line, and you could even make a LetraWire-like transmission with 600 ohm or 400 ohm open wire line. You can buy or build open wire transmission line today. Let me drop. So I come out with the output of my transmitter, which is 50 ohms. I go through a coaxial half-wave balun or some other kind of device that gives me at least a 4-to-1 step up of impedance. I do some kind of an impedance match and baluning function so that my 50 ohm coaxial cable is feeding open wire line, whether it be 400 ohm or 600 ohm open wire line that you either buy, sometimes called ladder line, you either buy or build. It's not a very difficult construction. Once you've got these two parallel wires of a transmission line, you can now put various devices across it to measure what is the voltage on that line. Even though your particular 400 ohm ladder line happens to be encased in rubber, you can now make a device which is a neon bulb with two wires coming out of the neon bulb, and the two wires come out long enough so that they scrape against the rubber above the open wire line. And maybe you put some kind of a flat plate out there so there's a little bit more capacitance. You don't want to scrape away the rubber on your open wire line. You don't have to. You just make a little bit of a metal plate there, maybe a quarter of a square centimeter, so to speak, at the end of each wire, which sits on top of the rubber. It now is capacitively coupled to the RF energy flowing down your open wire line. And with a couple of watts flowing down that open wire line, let me drop. This 400 ohm ladder line in my example, with a couple of watts flowing down it, with little bitty capacitor plates on the end of the wires that are scraping along the rubber right above the wires themselves, and those two wires come together at a neon bulb in the center, and you slide that along your ladder line, you will find a certain point where you get a peak in voltage and a certain point where you get a valley of voltage if there is standing wave ratio on the line. If the line was perfectly matched and you slide your neon bulb along it, you'll get constant brilliance. If you intentionally make the end of that open wire line, that ladder line, mismatched so that you know you're creating a standing wave ratio, and now you slide your neon bulb, you will find certain places where it lights up brightly and certain places where it doesn't light up at all. And you can measure precisely with your centimeter or meter, yardstick, so to speak. You can measure the positions and you can calibrate it. You can put the ink box along there and calibrate the places where you get peaks and valleys. And you will find out that the peaks and valleys are always a half wavelength apart between two peaks, a half wavelength apart between two valleys, a quarter wavelength apart between the adjacent peaks and valleys. That's the way standing wave ratio works. In the beginning, you not only measure standing wave ratio that way, let me drop, but you found out what frequency you were on, the length between the two, assuming now that you know that your ladder line has a velocity factor of 95%, and many open wire lines have a velocity factor of 95%. Therefore, you've got to make a 5% correction. But you measure the distance between the peaks of brilliance of the neon bulb or the valleys, you measure that distance, and you now know the wavelength that you're on when you make the 2-to-1 correction factor, because these are peaks are half wavelength apart, not a full wavelength apart. So if you're doing the measurement on 2 meters, you'd like to have at least a half wavelength of lateral line, so you'd like to have 1 meter of two parallel wires. By the way, you can do the same thing with coax cable by taking a piece of hardline coax cable, and with your Dremel tool, you could cut a slot in the outer conductor of the hardline cable, particularly 70 ohm or 90 ohm, 70 ohm hardline, the CATV stuff, you can cut a slot in the outer circular, the outer dimension, cut a slot that is longitudinal, and no radiation will take, from that take place on that slot. But now you can put a probe down that slot, sense the voltage that's on that center conductor, and again, move it along that line and look for the peaks and valleys of the voltage that you pick up by the capacitive coupling, so to speak, the leakage that you put, that you pick up when you put something in that slot. So you can make a slotted line, you can make electro wires, which is really open wire line. In either case, you will now see real wavelength really being demonstrated and real standing wave ratio being demonstrated. It's a beautiful science experiment. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good. I'm sure you can have a lot of fun with that because I made up something similar to that on a board with bell wire, insulated bell wire. And I had two copper thimbles that I threaded onto the wire and could run them back and forth. Across that, I put a neon bulb, and that was a lot of fun. And, you know, I did not remember to adjust for the velocity factor, but you could actually measure that. Now, of course, with my slotted line, I don't have to do that, but that was an interesting experiment. You're absolutely right. Okay, that's about it. I think we should go over to Paul, maybe, unless you have other comments, and what's happening in space. I'm sure he's got a long report for us tonight. KC2WGB.
We're going to exchange for a moment.
Yeah, history is repeating itself, John. Take a look what's going on here. In the very beginning, you didn't even have a frequency meter. That took place a decade downrange of us doing transmitting. Another decade or two downrange, we could actually make a frequency counter. All you could measure in the very beginning is wavelength on some kind of a transmission line where you look for peaks and valleys of voltage or current or lighting up a light bulb. So you measured wavelength. That's how we called it, the 80 meter band, the 20 meter band, the 10 meter band, the 15 meter band, the 2 meter band, the 6 meter band, and so on. We measured wavelength first. How do we measure light? Right now, I'm looking at my front panel of my transmitter that I'm talking to you on, and the center frequency of my eyes are 540 nanometers. Light we measure in wavelength. It's a classic repeated. We haven't got a frequency counter yet. The actual frequency, let me drop it. The actual frequency of that light coming into my eye is 10 to the 14 hertz, 10 to the 15 hertz. It's a great big number. The day will come when we'll measure that exact frequency. And maybe the day has already come. But right now, we measure it in wavelength. The beginning, the easiest thing to measure is wavelength. At some later time, you measure frequency in, by counting, and then later than that, you start measuring phase angle. I mean, in the beginning, we had nothing but a wave meter, which was a resonator, and you looked at what frequency it resonated because you calculated the inductor and the capacitor, and you say, hey, I must be on 7 megacycles. I must be on the 40 meter band. Later on, you had a real frequency counter, and later on, you could not only count the frequency, you could measure the phase angle of the signal flowing down that line. And when you put phase angle and voltage measurements together, it's called a vector voltage analyzer. And you measure S parameters. In the case of light right now, we can only measure wavelength. The day will come when we'll measure frequency. The day will come when we'll measure frequency and phase. And already we do have the equivalent of time domain reflectometry with light systems. When you send a pulse down a fiber optic cable, let me drop. And you measure the amount of light that reflects back because there was a mismatch somewhere. So that is a scalar vector, the scalar network analyzer, not a vector. You're not measuring phase angle of light yet. And you're not really counting frequency of light yet. But you're coming close. So right now we've got a scalar network analyzer for light systems. We have time domain reflectometry for light systems. So we're measuring amplitude of reflection, and we're measuring magnitude of reflection, and we're measuring wavelength today. The day will come when we'll measure frequency, and phase angle of that frequency, and therefore there will be real S parameters of light frequencies. It's just a matter of time. Wes has got a question for all of the above. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
N2XJN, I think if we could go to Space Report right now, I've got a confirmation that Dr. Roy is going to be available at 11, around 11, and I think we're going to have a interesting discussion about harmonics. N2XJN.
Okay, WS2N. Hey, Paul. Time for the Space Report. I think this is going to be Space Report number 140 of the series that began way back in your youth. And I think we're approaching 130 astronomical units for the Voyager number one spacecraft. WS2N with the Space Report, K2RIW, you got a call.
This is WS2N. Yeah, Dick. Well, you're up to 130.7. Well, you know, I go by the... from the sun, so it's still getting higher and higher. If you go by the Earth, it changes. Right now, both of them, Voyager 1, Voyager 2, are actually going backwards if you measure the distance from Earth to their voyages. That's because the Earth is traveling actually in the direction of the voyages right now. At this time of year, they're going at, we're roughly at, 60,000 miles per hour going around the sun. You know, we can get up to that speed, and then if the voyages are moving away between 30 and 40,000 miles per hour, you're going to have a real change, but only for 6 months of the year, and then it reverses.
Dick, I want to talk about Dawn and the ion engines, which we've been talking about quite a bit recently, and wanted to know if they were gimbaled. Well, it turns out, what we said there a couple of weeks ago, that it does have three ion engines, and yes, they are gimbaled. They can be moved in two different axes. Each of the three engines is 30 centimeters in diameter, so that's like 10, probably like 12-inch diameter. Rocket engines, ion engines. So the thrust that they get out of that can definitely be changed, not only from a change in the axis of each engine, but actually just putting a different engine on. And it turns out they really needed the two, switch from one to the other. And actually the third, I read that they used as a spare because one of the two failed, which never happened. It took a while, but finally realized that I have to go through a lot of different websites, going through a couple of them. I just don't trust it when I come across one website. They are offset, roughly about 22 and a half degrees, it looks like, from one another. So that helps in maneuverability, makes it easier sometimes where they don't have to use the momentum wheels to change them. Now, they had four momentum wheels on there, gyro type things to change the attitude of the spacecraft by spinning them up and slowing them down. And, they had four on there, similar to Kepler. Two of theirs, one of theirs failed. In case the other one fails, they have a backup plan. So there's another case of the wheels that are used quite a bit to change the attitude of the spacecraft do eventually wear out. It happened on Kepler, and now it happened on Dawn. It happened on Dawn a while back, so no big deal. They've already got this big, so it's successfully in orbit around the biggest asteroid, Ceres, right now. Wanted to bring that up. I know we talked about that. And also, spoke a lot about, well, we will be anyway, a couple of months talking about the New Horizons spacecraft on the way to Pluto. They just had a minute and a half burn of the rocket. Big course correction to get it a little closer. closer to Pluto, it'll come around 8,000 miles from the planet when it does pass Pluto in July 14th of this year. Now, this thing was launched, you know, like almost 10 years ago, and a lot of people are very anxious, especially the early workers involved with New Horizons. Some of them have been working on this project for 20 years. In fact, they had a different name for it at one time. It's been called the Pluto Express, but then eventually got the name New Horizons. You know, 10 years of work on a project, and 10 years to get there. And their mission won't be over after they pass Pluto. They're going to have an extended mission by 2019, so roughly 4 years from now, they'll be passing a Kuiper Belt object. Plan on getting close up, taking pictures, and using their instruments to detect what's going on with one of those. And that would be the first time, of course, that they do that. And so it'll take you know, almost 4 years to get there. So that'll be at least probably another three AU out from probably more than that from Pluto. So we'll be talking about that in June. And just want to talk about the Kepler to these three main missions. Are pretty interesting. Kepler, I know we've talked about quite a bit with their K2 mission. Kepler's momentum wheels, like I mentioned before, it failed, and they thought it was going to be a lost cause. Well, you know, NASA being the way they are, really, I think this one, we can't handle it, got it, Space Center. They figured out, let's use the sun's rays to control the attitude of the spacecraft to keep it steady. They don't have the use of these momentum wheels anymore. And what they did is look at Kepler. It's got solar panels. And solar panels, they're not sticking out like Dawn, you know. Dawn's solar panels end-to-end is like 60 feet. It's like the length of a tractor-trailer truck. Kepler is different. It's if you can picture, you take a Coke can and put it on a table and wrap the solar panels around it, but not all the way around it. You know, instead of running, eight-sided system of solar panels, you know, take four away, and now you'll have four. Two of those four are cut in the fashion of a triangle. So basically, we have two that are coming to a point. If you point that at the sun, have the photons of the sun, you know, pushing against that at one spot, it will balance it. It balance it out, and that's how they're doing it. And it'll stay stable if the Kepler, remember, is not orbiting the Earth. It's trailing behind the Earth. When it was first launched, that was the plan, to have it drifting behind the Earth. It actually orbits the Sun every 370-some-odd days. So its year is a little longer than our year. So every year that goes by, it actually drifts behind us further, you know, every year. But with that, they had it at one time, you know, facing it only in one direction for its whole three-year time while it was looking for extra exoplanets, which found thousands of them. But now to continue the mission, they're not looking at one spot in the sky. It's the deal where they're looking wherever it might be in relationship to the, the galactical situation. You know, half the year it might be pointing toward the center of the galaxy, the other half it might be looking away. But the whole time the sun is in the middle and it's balancing So they're the main topics there.
I wanted to bring up, the three astronauts came back from the International Space Station and landed successfully in Kazakhstan. Got our American astronaut back, a European astronaut, and a Russian astronaut. And another $70 million out the window. You know, I mean, they're doing productive work when they're up there, but that's what it's costing to put our astronaut up there, an average of almost three times a year. So hopefully we'll move away from that with the commercial space race that's going on. One other mission that was interesting to watch last Saturday night was the MMS mission. I know we've talked about that here on the net. It's the magnetic sphere multi-scale spacecraft mission. And that was launched by an Atlas V in the 4-2-1 configuration, 4, meaning that the Atlas bearing, the diameter where the MMS spacecraft was sitting was 4 meters in diameter. And the 2 stands for 2 solid booster rockets that are used, and the 1 is for the Centaur upper stage. And that successfully launched, and I saw that live, and it took them quite a long time, about an hour and a half before the spacecraft started to separate. These spacecraft, if you were to stand in the ready room whenever we get this thing putting it together and looked at the stack, there were 4 spacecraft, and it would look like it was standing next to a 2-story building. Each one was a little over 4 feet tall and 12 feet in diameter. 8-sided figures. And when they launched they had 1, 2, 3, 4. Number 4 was launched first. So that was the top of the stack. And then 3 and then 2. And they would spin it up each time they launched a spacecraft. The Centaur would spin. This way it would have rotation. And it would separate from the stack. So number 4 went 3, 2, and 1, and it all went very successful. It's going to have highly elliptical orbits, starting a little on the low side. And when I say low, it means it'll probably be 10 times the radius of the Earth eventually. See if they're going to increase the height of the orbit. You're going to have a naturally low perigee, it's going to be highly elliptical, but the apogee will be almost halfway to the moon. The idea of this whole MMS project, spacecraft is going to be to measure for the first time magnetic reconnection of the magnetic sphere. It breaks apart and then it reconnects all the time. They've never been able to measure this. And with these 4 spacecraft flying in formation, sometimes 6 miles apart, maybe sometimes 60 miles apart, they'll be talking to each other, but they'll be taking measurements. And as they go through these 2 points, there's 2 points, one on the sun side of the Earth and one on the opposite side of the Earth. Because they have 4 spacecraft, they'll be able to take all the pictures, data in 3 dimensions. That's the goal. They have 3 main pieces of equipment on board. They have, I'm talking about for detection. They have four of them, heavy walls that pull out from the spacecraft. Each spacecraft is spinning, and it will reel out these long wires, and they're going to be probably about 60 meters long, each one. And then you've got these 5-meter mechanical arm things that are going to come out also from the side of the spacecraft, so that will be in the spin axis. And they'll have some kind of magnetometers on board. axis, you know, what's going to come out of the zenith part of it, and the elements out of the native part of it, and they're going to, it looks like two radio towers, and they're going to be quite high too. They'll pick up the electrical field, and with all these detections, plus some other detection equipment on board, they plan on trying to figure out magnetic reconnection, which will eventually give them a better handle of space weather. Space weather, of course, could be detrimental to satellites, even the power grid here on Earth.
So they're roughly some of the topics I have here, Dick. Equipment on board, these four spacecraft I found fascinating. So I read up quite a bit about it. You know, they got like 70 amp hour batteries, lithium ion batteries on hand, good for some 900 charges. So that's going to go on for quite a few years. They have a planned extended missions on these things too, as well. I don't know if you've read anything about these things, Dick, but they're fascinating. The MMS mission. Back to you, anybody else, any questions or comments? Let me drop it.
The MMS mission is in what kind of an orbit, Paul?
Roughly 24 degrees, 26 degrees inclination, but highly elliptical. You know, maybe your aperture will be 500 miles, and the perigee might be, 30 or 40,000 miles out, and eventually that'll extend to over 80,000 on the aperture.
Fantastic. The Dawn ionic engine, you told me once before, and I've forgotten, roughly how much thrust does the ionic engine give?
Any of the descriptions I've either read or seen in interviews, it's the equivalent of taking, you know, a piece of paper, you know, 8x11 piece of paper, put it in your hand, and that's the weight. If you were to, you fly one of these things up to space, it would take roughly 4 days to increase the speed to 60 miles an hour, so 0 to 60 in 4 days.
Okay. When it comes to aligning Kepler by way of solar pressure, one of the things I looked up with Wikipedia is that the solar pressure at the Earth radius, at the Earth distance from the Sun, is 9 micropascal. A pascal is a newton per square meter. So if you had a square meter of absorption of solar energy, you would be getting 9 micro newtons of force. And by the same token, I'm guessing there's a way we can rate the Dawn ionic engine in millinewtons or micronewtons. But the weight of an 8x10 piece of paper, I guess, comes pretty close. We can figure out what that is. Pretty good. By the way, whenever any spacecraft goes out of Earth orbit, and it goes into space to some other place, like, for instance, New Horizons. Let me drop it. It's real easy to think that, hey, it's out into free space. Uh-oh. As soon as it leaves Earth orbit, it just happens to be another object in some kind of an orbit around the Sun. The Sun is highly dominant with its central gravity field. New Horizons is really climbing up away from the Sun, if you know what I mean, until it gets close to Pluto. Kepler is in orbit around the Sun, and it happens to be in orbit just a tiny bit larger than the Earth. That's why it's 370 days and 365 days. So it's a solar orbiting object. And now that we know that the solar pressure is 9 micropascal, and you know how much area you've got of your solar cells, you can easily figure out how fast it can reorient itself. And I'm very glad to hear that the Dawn engines are gimbaled.